Welcome to Parshas Bereishis, and welcome to 5767. May we all be blessed, continuously be blessed, with a happy and healthy and sweet year. And may we learn a lot together. Before I go on, the question that you should be asking me is, what approach are we going to take this year? Because most of you here who have been coming for several years, at least, know that every year we try to take a unique approach to the Chumash. In some years we've used a unique particular commentator. Last year we didn't use a particular commentator. We were integrating some of the comments from the previous years. And that was interesting. What I thought of for this year is to select in every parsha a conversation or two that goes on between Hashem and people, and listen in very carefully to that conversation, and imagine that we're the people in the conversation and Hashem is conversing with us, and see what it sounds like. So the title I came up with was Conversations with Hashem, Musar and Pre-Kabbalah Insights. What inspired this thought was that it just seems to me that the presentation of Judaism, I think in general in our age, has shifted or has included the concept of a Jew having a relationship with Hashem more. I think that this concept or this way of presenting Judaism is somewhat of a new twist, or at least a new sound. I don't remember growing up as a school child hearing this. I don't remember the teacher or the parent saying, we have a relationship with Hashem. I don't remember hearing that so much. These are the things that we do. These are the mitzvahs. We fulfill the commandments. We observe, etc. This type of talking of having a relationship with Hashem, I think, is much more prevalent. And it may be prevalent in our community because we have been blessed by a Rav and Rabbanim, many of whom studied under Harav Yaakov Weinberg of blessed memory, and this was something that he emphasized tremendously anywhere he spoke. So I believe that that's a big part of it. And it really adds a whole dimension to what Judaism is and what the Torah is. So to me, this would be a step in deepening our understanding. A relationship with Hashem, does that imply that, like, I talk to him, that he's talking to me, that he has something personal to say? Well, it's true, isn't it? In the Chumash, Hashem does talk to people. Hashem talks to Adam and Chava. Well, maybe we should put ourselves in their place and imagine that he's talking to us. And then we could hopefully discover, what does it mean to have a relationship with Hashem? So that's the approach. It's not a particular commentator, but it is a particular focus in every parsha, trying to find. If we don't find it, we'll have to look for the next best, maybe a conversation between people. But I think it's going to be very common that we will find conversations with Hashem going on in the parshias. And we'll start, please God, today. Now, as far as the subtitle, the Parsha with Musar and Pre-Kabbalah Insights. Pre-Kabbalah is concepts that I've learned which may be in the direction of Kabbalah, but I've never been told that I've studied Kabbalah, and therefore I can't say that these are Kabbalah insights. But since I've heard that they are in the direction, I could say they're pre-Kabbalah insights. And what does it mean, Kabbalah? I'll tell you what I think Kabbalah does. To the average observer, I don't mean observant, I mean observer, you look around the world and everything is fragmented, which means everything is separate. People are separate. Objects are separate. Places are separate. Days are separate. Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. And you think even in the more religious or spiritual realm, things are separate. Man is separate from God. Heaven is separate from earth. Everything is separate. Everything is broken apart and fragmented. And you can particularly see that in human interactions. People are separate. I'm me, and you're you. I remember Rabbi Feldman saying in big, big Jewish cities, they may not all act the way you would do in a small town. When you see somebody in a small town like Atlanta used to be, you would meet somebody on the street and, you know, you would talk because you're good friends. Because you were good friends. But in big cities, there could be people that look like you, talk like you, act like you, but you don't know them. Rabbi Emanuel Feldman was saying that one time he was walking in Jerusalem and he passed somebody in the street or in the hallway and he said, Good Shabbos or Shalom Aleichem. And the person says, Do I know you? So that seems to be like a human condition. It's separate. But with a little bit of study, we are taught that things are actually more joined. We talk about there's prayer. I pray to God. I can do that in the privacy of my home. But then we're supposed to go to the minyan. We're supposed to have communal prayer. That's better than davening by yourself, right? Plus, many of the teachings. We are all one. We are all related. What does that mean? All Jews are brothers and sisters. What does that mean, brothers and sisters? I'm not your brother. She's not my sister. We're from different families. I never met her before. Oh, yeah, but we're all connected. What does that mean? How about the teaching? It's a song. Yisrael, v'yoraisa, v'kudsha b'richu chadhu. Israel and the Torah and God are one. That just sounds like gibberish. Plain, downright gibberish. What do you mean Israel and God and the Torah are one? Israel and God are one? Israel are people, God is God. He's the creator, we're the creatures. What does it mean? So there is a level of understanding in which you can begin to see how things are connected. In fact, I think that this is what we say every single day when we say the Shema. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Here, Israel, Hashem is our God, Hashem is one. What does that mean, Hashem is one? Hashem is one what? One God? There's only one God, there aren't multiple gods? Okay, that's part of it. But we don't believe in different gods. But it's more than that. Hashem Echad. Really, everything is one because everything emanates from God. And since God is the source, everything is connected. That's ultimately what I think it means. Well, Kabbalah, to me, is the study and the teachings of how things are related. And in order to see that, you really have to go beneath the surface. You have to go to the level of the spiritual or the soul. You know, two people together are not the same if you look at the body. If you look with the eyes, then they're separate. If you look beneath the surface, they could be one. So I think that's what Kabbalah attempts to do. Not only people, but ideas. I think that the standard experience of learning, our experiences is you study the Torah, you hear a Devar Torah. And it's a very nice message, right? I heard a Devar Torah on the Parsha. I really liked it. It was meaningful to me. I understood it. It inspired me. Next week, I will hear a different Devar Torah. That will also inspire me, and I will also like it, and it will also be meaningful to me. And then the following week, I'll also hear a Devar Torah. That's wonderful. It really is. But did we stop to think about whether the Devar Torah from last week and the Devar Torah from this week actually interrelate? Do we interrelate the book of Bereishis with the book of Shemos? Is there some type of a holistic thread that makes the Torah a seamless whole from beginning to end? I believe there is. I believe that after all is said and done, the Torah is trying to give us a message which on some level can probably be reduced to something like Hashem Echad. Except that if you just look at it page by page, you do not see that thread. Kabbalah is the study of how things are starting to fit together, and there are actually patterns. So it's very exciting to me. What's the source for this type of study? So we have some pre-Kabbalah sources, and you know them because I have shared them with you. I actually share with you everything I know. I know about 50 hours a week worth of information. That's all I know. And you got it. Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, Expositions of the Torah, based on Kabbalah. Because right away he starts off with, what's the underlying principle? He doesn't tell the story of the Torah. He tells the point of the Torah. The point. He doesn't say, in the beginning of the book, he doesn't say, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. He says, this is what God is, and this is what he was doing, and why he created heaven and earth, and this is why he created Adam, and this is what Adam was doing when he was in the Garden of Eden, and this is how he left the Garden of Eden because of his sin, and this is what Abraham was doing to rectify what Adam was doing. You see, everything is related, and what Abraham did was continued by what Yitzchak did, and eventually there were 12 tribes, and eventually they went to Mitzrayim, and that was for the purpose of whatever rectifying. So he's weaving together a continuous flow. And that's what pre-Kabbalah is anyway. And then, I believe that ties in with Musar. Because Musar is taking the study, understanding it intellectually, and then going beyond that, down into the heart and into the personal reaction to that learning. Taking it to heart and being inspired to the point of clarifying one's own purpose and goals and that influencing their life. That's Musar. And I believe that it's much easier to be inspired to the point of changing and growing and developing when one understands that things are related. Because, as Rabbi Luzzatto said himself, in the introduction to the book Derech Hashem, The Way of God, I just want to read to you in his introduction, because Rabbi Luzzatto was the master of the idea of organizing and creating connections between things. And what he writes is, introduction, when one knows a number of things and understands how they are categorized and systematically interrelated, then he has a great advantage over one who has the same knowledge without such distinction. It is very much like the difference between looking at a well-arranged garden planted in rows and patterns and seeing a wild thicket or forest growing in confusion. And so, therefore, the process of study is not just to understand pieces and little tidbits, but to understand how they are arranged. Because you can be sure that God is a painter, is a sculptor, is a master craftsman, and the world that he created is a masterpiece. And if we don't see that as a masterpiece, if we don't see how events, if we don't see how history is a tapestry, if we don't see how events, large and small, are all interrelated, and we can't see everything, but if we don't believe it and have a sense, then we're missing something big, and it's going to be harder to be inspired. I believe that pre-Kabbalah is the power for Musar, just in terms of understanding. Okay, enough said. That is where I'm at, and we're at together. With that backdrop, we'd like to listen in on some conversations. So, in the story of Bereishis, we have Adam and Eve. They are, of course, as we know, created on the sixth day, and a lot happened that day. First of all, Adam and Eve are both created. And by the way, we cannot understand Bereishis really simply. It's not easy to understand it. One of the teachers of our class 2 years ago, Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz, said that all of the parshios of the Torah can be understood on a simple level. There's many levels beneath that, but it could be understood on a simple level. Bereishis and Noach can't. Bereishis and Noach requires deep explanation. Because so many supernatural things happen. I mean, creation is supernatural. And how God made a woman out of a man. The whole thing is just not simple. Everything else basically is within our lexicon. So he creates them. He separates them. They have children. And they are placed in the Garden of Eden. And they're given the permission to eat from every delectable tree except for the one in the middle, the Eitz Hadas Tovara, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Chava is enticed by the serpent to taste from it. She does, and she gives some to Adam, and he tastes. And God confronts Adam and Eve and ends up banishing them from the garden. All of that happened on a busy Friday afternoon or Friday morning. And from then on, it was decreed that all Fridays should be hectic. We have a lot to do, and it's always busy. If we could just hang on, we'll get to Shabbos. And Hashem said that to Adam, too. If you just hang on today, if you can just make it through today and don't violate the commandment, you'll be in the clear forever. Shucks. What's interesting, what I like to listen in, is on the first time that there's actually a give and take between Hashem and Adam is in the aftermath of the tree of knowledge. In chapter 3, verse 8, page 16 and 17, 3:8. Vayishmeu es kol Hashem Elokim yishalech bagan leruach hayom vayishabei ha'adam v'ishto mipnei Hashem Elokim v'soch etz hagan. They heard the sound of Hashem manifesting itself in the garden toward evening. And the man and his wife hid from Hashem God among the trees of the garden. Vayikra Hashem Elokim el ha'adam vayomer lo ayeka. Hashem God called out to the man and said to him, "Where are you? Where are you?" Vayomer. He said, Adam answered, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I'm naked. So I hid." It sounds more like he's answering why rather than where. Right? The question was, "Where are you?" The answer was, "I hid because I was afraid." Didn't really answer the question. He didn't say, I'm hiding behind the trees. I remember that Jewish album, You Don't Have to Be Jewish, the Jewish humor, back in the 60s. We had that in our house. Every once in a while I share with you one of the routines in there. So the European couple, he comes home from work. "Honey, I'm home. Where are you?" "I'm hiding. I got a surprise for you. Where are you?" "I'm hiding. I got you those gold earrings you wanted. Where are you?" "I'm hiding in the front closet." So the question was, "Where are you?" And the answer was, "Why am I here?" And then Hashem says, "Mihi bayomer mihi gilocha ki erom ata. Hamin ho'eitz asher tivisicha levilti achol mimeno achalta." And he said, "Who told you that you are naked? Have you eaten of the tree from which I commanded you not to eat?" You know, earlier when God first created them, it says in the end of chapter 2, the last verse, "Vayihiyu shnehem arumim, ha'adam v'ishto v'lo yisboshashu." They were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. Which means that being naked was not a reason to hide. So if Adam is saying to Hashem, "Well, I had to hide because I was afraid, because it's not presentable for me to be like this in front of you," Hashem says, "Well, that didn't stop you before. What changed? What makes you all of a sudden be afraid that you're naked? What you're really admitting to me is that a change happened." And who told Adam to hide in the first place? So pre-Kabbalah tells us that there's a reason why Adam hid. And there's a reason why he was afraid, because he was naked. And that reason is because, and for those of you who have been here before, this is repetition. But repetition is good because it reminds us of things that we need to hear. There is an underlying foundation and cause of everything. God's purpose for creation, and it's not presumptuous of me to say this, because I didn't say it, Rabbi Lusato did. And Rabbi Lusato knows it because this is the age, wisdom, and knowledge of the Torah, way back to the beginning. And if you don't see this in the lines of the Chumash, it's just because this is pre-Kabbalah. It's the predicate of everything. It is the basic assumption of everything, that God created the world and man for a purpose. And that purpose is to know Him, for man to know God, and to derive absolute delight and pleasure and ecstasy in that knowledge. It was totally for man's benefit. It was an act of sheer and utter chesed, kindness. God wanted to share Himself with someone else. He wanted to do chesed. Hashem has everything. He is everything. He wants others to share that goodness. So He created a creature to accept and receive that goodness. And by the way, the address of that goodness and that experience of joy and ecstasy is not Jerusalem, not 1855 La Vista Road, not New York, but it's nowhere in this world. The address from that pleasure and experience is in a different world, which we're not there. It's called Olam Haba. It's called the world to come. Well, then why didn't Hashem, if He wanted to give us this great, good experience, just create Olam Haba and put us there? And we'd be walking in to this delicious banquet and feasting. Says Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lozato, it's his acronym, because if you get invited to a banquet for no apparent merit or reason on your part, it's not as enjoyable as when you are invited because you did something to deserve to be invited. There's much greater pleasure when you earn something and receive it than when you're given it as a free gift. In fact, getting free gifts make many people feel uncomfortable and ashamed, and sometimes even difficult to look at the giver in the face. Because I feel beholden to you, because you gave me something and I gave you nothing in return. If I feel like I deserved what you gave me, then that makes us close. That makes us equal. I did something for you, and therefore you did something for me. That's a close bond. That's a relationship. So how is God going to give this pleasurable experience to man unless man has an opportunity to earn it? And therefore God said, before I bring man to the banquet, I'm going to place him in a different world, in a world in which he will not automatically behold and perceive me, in which he will be able to perceive me and to connect with me if he tries to do so, if he seeks me and finds me. If he can connect with me by his own efforts, then he will earn the right to be my close, beloved friend for the rest of eternity. And then it will be truly his pleasure. And that's why God created this world. This is the world in which we are placed here with the opportunity and the wherewithal and the resources to connect with God by our choice. And we have a lifetime to do that, and we also can do that as a community, but we're not going to talk about that right now. Adam, single Eve, have the opportunity in this world to choose to be connected with God. They also have the opportunity and the resources to choose not to be connected with God. And that's what happened in the Garden of Eden. They were given that choice. If you stay away from that tree, you will be connected with me forever, but it'll be your choice. If you eat from that tree, what's going to happen to you, says Rabbi Lozato, is you are going to become more detached from me than you already are. Let me make something clear. In order for God to create man and give him the opportunity to connect, he has to create man as some separate being. If he wouldn't be separate, then he couldn't choose to come together. But there's a fine line between being separate and yet longing to connect and being so separate that you don't want to connect. That's the fine line. That's what happened in the Garden of Eden. Initially, Adam was created with separateness, but with the clear vision and the clear longing to connect with God, such that there were no barriers between man and God. He could be whoever he is without any barriers, without any embarrassment. Man was totally pure and pristine and able to connect with God without barriers. And when he ate from the tree, he became separate to the point where he couldn't even be in the same space with God. He had to hide. He had to say, I can't be with you, God. I'm too embarrassed. I'm too afraid. I'm too separated. That's what happened. And that's why God said to him, where are you? You used to be with me. Now you're separate. You're hiding. And he was so separate and he was so afraid that he couldn't even speak the truth. He couldn't even tell God what really happened, as if he was so separate he thought maybe God didn't even know what he was thinking, as if he could hide his thoughts from God. And God told him, I know what happened. You're never that detached from me. You're always connected with me. That's what happened. And not only is this a Devar Torah, which I hope you don't say this Devar Torah at your table because everyone's going to leave, but not only is this a Devar Torah for Parshas Bereishis, but do you see how this is the conversation which goes on every single day with every single person with God? Isn't God always calling out to us and saying, Ayeka? And aren't we hiding? And aren't we trying to say, well, I'm hiding because da-da-da-da-da, not so eager to come out and say, God, help me. I'm distant from you. Help me come back. Help me with my fear. Help me with my shame. Isn't that conversation happening every day? Do we hear God calling Ad Ayeka? Well, this, our Parsha says that yes, God is calling out Ayeka. Every day he's calling out Ayeka. Every day of our life. And our challenge is to hear that. And our challenge is to come out of hiding and ask God, what should I do to connect to you? Horeini Hashem Darkecha. Hashem, show me the path to reunite. That's what the rest of history is for man to reunite with God. Okay, questions?
Yeah, after what you just said, my questions seem very small in comparison to your last point, which was, I thought, kind of on the money. But two technical questions. One is, Adam wasn't aware of the consequences of his actions when he took them. You said a minute ago that he made the conscious decision to choose separation from God. But I don't see that when I read this parsha. You know, it seems to me that he was seduced into believing somehow that he would be given great pleasure to eat from the tree of knowledge.
That is true. But earlier, when God placed man in the Garden of Eden, Hashem, God, commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of knowledge of good and bad you must not eat thereof, for on the day you eat of it you shall surely die. And it's true that he was enticed, actually Chava was enticed, they were enticed by the great allure that the tree had, which raises the question, and this is really a very great springboard to talk about this, is that what is the, I think Rabbi Feldman, he's got a wonderful, wonderful book, Biblical Questions, and the first chapter is on the question of Ayeka, where are you? And I encourage you, if you have this, to read that chapter, and also the second chapter, which is about the ensuing conversation with Chava, in which God says to her, what is this that you have done? And Rabbi Feldman has a chapter on those words. What is this that you have done? But it is a good question over here. That if a person understands that there will be consequences, and the main consequence will be a separation from God, what is it that is so enticing that overpowers that consequence? Is it that man, at the time of his enticement, forgets that he will be separated from God? Does he forget? Is there some type of an amnesia that sets in? You know, that's a question. And to understand...
Isn't it the evil within us that sort of bribes us into believing, as rabbis would say, that we can do this and get away with it, and
right.
it's a deal, and basically we're good people after all, and all of that?
Right, right, exactly. I mean, what is it that we tell ourselves? And this is a study in our own nature. And that's really, Rabbi Feldman explains, the question to Eve is to overcome that rationalization. In fact, Rabbi Feldman says that not only does a person rationalize before he commits the sin, he even rationalizes it afterwards, because he doesn't want to think of himself as guilty. And the proof is, Adam did not want to think of himself as guilty, because what did he say to God when God said, "Did you eat from the tree?" What did he say? "She gave it to me." So what he's saying is, I'm not at fault. God then turns to Chava and says, "What have you done?" What did she say? "The serpent gave it to me." So even after the act is done, there is a hesitation for the person to admit it. And that's why God says to Chava, "Ma zos asis? What is this that you have done?" And Rabbi Feldman beautifully explains this phrase, "What have you done?" Let me read to you a few lines. The classical biblical question word, ma, found over 90 times in Genesis alone, the ma, for what, is a challenge hurled at the sinner. Having done what he wishes, having followed his own impulse, he is by now very likely justifying his action and might be considering a repeat performance. But the one-syllable word, ma, pulls him up short. What? Or, what? With this question suddenly before him, the sinner finds himself confronted by someone who is scrutinizing his deed. The question is an accusing finger. What have you done? Its very directness penetrates his being and echoes and reverberates within him, creating doubts and second thoughts. At the peak of his satisfaction at having pulled off his personal rebellion against authority comes ma. His action is being questioned, and his deed is being doubted. What I did felt so right. Is it possible that it was wrong? A huge question mark has been placed at his feet. You know, God doesn't even have to accuse him. He just has the question, what are you doing? Because that's all a person needs. A person just needs a jolt. Instead of this continuing to rationalize, the question what stops that. Just think. You know. So all of these words, all these questions should be echoing. We are to hear them echoing always. First of all, ayeka. Doing the wrong thing, choosing to go against God, has its consequence. The main consequence is we hide. We hide more and more. We become further and further and create a barrier. And secondly, in order to prevent ourselves from just going off into oblivion, we have to hear the words, what? What are you doing? What have you done? That's enough. That's enough to begin to get the ball to bounce the other way. If we just take those few words, ayeka and ma zos asis, we are empowered with very, very strong and powerful words, and we can actually hear that conversation having with Hashem. And in case we give the answers, which probably we will, is, well, I was afraid, or I was hiding, or somebody else made me do it. Just remember, that's what Adam said, that's what Chava said, and Hashem didn't accept it. You know, still your deed. Ma zos asis, you did it. What is it that you have done? Don't blame it on somebody else. Rabbi Feldman says, there is no other perpetrator of this act but you. You cannot blame anyone else. You must take responsibility for it. It is no defense to claim that he, or she, or my parents, or my upbringing, or my environment, or society did it. How often are people excused in our society because it's not their fault, it's society's fault? Ma zos asis says no. You have to take responsibility. You did it, so it's your act. Ask yourself the question. So that's the first conversation that we learn from Bereshis. Hashem is talking to us. Notice how he doesn't just let us stay in the bushes. He comes after us and he probes. He wants us to be connected. That's why He created us. So if we don't come back on our own, Hashem is always talking to us. Ayeka mazo sasis.
In this verse, it says, a man and his wife hid from Hashem God among the trees of the garden, as if it were possible to hide from God. But of course, everyone knows you can't.
That's part of the illusion of being separate from God, is you don't see God. And you start to think that He doesn't know what you're doing. That's part of that illusion.
There's a comparable issue when God calls out to man, where are you? Of course God knows where you are.
Uh-huh.
Physically.
Yeah.
And spiritually, probably, as well. So there's this physical nature of this verse, mm-hmm. but it's not about that at all.
Right.
It's about where you're holding.
Where you're holding, exactly. And it's not something that God is asking for His good. He's asking the question for Adam's good. It's a rhetorical question. Adam, do you know where you are? I know where you are. Do you know where you are?
Right.
I know what you did. Do you know what you did? Right.
I'm a little bit confused because the notion of about this, a lot of this was preordained. That God didn't want to just plunk us into the Garden of Eden. He wanted us to earn it.
Not the Garden of Eden. He didn't want to plunk us into the world to come. The Garden of Eden is not the world to come, because in the world to come, there are no choices. In the Garden of Eden, there are choices. But they're easier choices.
But prior to the sin, Adam's sin,
he was not in the world to come.
He
was still in this world, but he was in a place in this world where all he had to do was make it through Friday, and he would have been able to go to the world to come. In other words, he was given a choice, but it was a relatively easy choice.
Mm-hmm.
All the odds were in his favor.
Right.
He did not have an internal evil inclination, and he only had one mitzvah, and all he had to do was just basically fill up on other things.
The anteroom of the world.
Exactly. And now this world is the anteroom. But this world is a lot longer, is a lot more complicated. There's many more things to do. And because we have so much farther to come back to reunite with Hashem, because there have been barriers. So, in a sense, that was a consequence of that first sin. We have much more ground to cover. But don't worry, Hashem guides us through that process too. And that's the story of the Torah. Except for chapter 1, the rest of the Torah is a guidebook for the post-sin Adam. And so therefore there's a lot of information and a lot of guidance on how to even recover post the sin. And that's what the Torah is for. Yeah.
So is the expression we use, are we using it incorrectly? We always talk about, oh, that'll be Gan Eden.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like paradise.
Mm-hmm.
We use that. We're not really,
mm-hmm.
that's not really accurate then, is mm-hmm. it? We're really talking about
Olam Haba.
Yes.
Well, except that Ramchal also establishes that when people die, they're not in Olam Haba, really. They're in the soul world. Because God said that if you eat from the tree, you will die. That doesn't mean you will die on the spot. It means you will, in order to reunite with God, you will have to go through the process of death and some type of purification that will happen during that stage. And then you can be recreated and reunited with God. So that is what we talk about. I think that's known as Gan Eden, but it's the virtual Gan Eden with just the souls. And the bodies are down below and the souls are in Gan Eden. It's also a very pleasurable because there are no choices. And that there's a lot of rest and peace in Gan Eden. But he calls that the soul world, which is like a waiting room for the
We're
the ultimate.
We're thinking physical, though, when we say that, aren't we?
Yeah, as an analogy. Because that's all we can perceive of.
Yeah.
We can't perceive of anything but our physical existence. I heard a great line from a life insurance salesman. I think I heard him say this. I'd like to get a life insurance policy. So he says, well, how long are you planning to be dead? That's a real question, you know, in Jewish tradition. Death is only a stage. It is. There's a wonderful book of the laws of mourning, and in that book, it was written maybe 100 years ago, and in that book, it compares the period of death, between death and the resurrection and the coming to the world to come. in the same terms as the gestation of an embryo inside the mother. The baby inside the mother thinks that that's all there is. You know, when the baby comes out, they're gone. But in truth, that's just the gestation as a prelude to real life. And the same thing is true. This life and even the ensuing death is all the gestation period for the Olam Haba, for the world to come. But it's a very, very important gestation period because that's where we exercise our choices and that's where we determine what kind of a life in the world to come we're going to have. That's why this world is so important. And we cherish life so much because after we're gone, we will eventually live forever. But we can't make any more changes, at least by our choices, in who we are and how we will connect to God. That we can only do here. After a person passes from this world, they can still continue to be elevated by virtue of all of the good deeds that they have done that have influenced other people. And every time a person does a mitzvah, it elevates not just that person, but also the parents and those who have been the influence for that. So even after a person passes from this world, they can continue to be elevated, but not as directly as when we have the free choice to do it ourselves.
Oh.
Shkoach.
Good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos. Look forward to the next conversation with you.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.